drawing room over here.
Hey, it's great to see you. We've been waiting. There's heaps to talk about.
Now, depending on who you talk to, stem cell research might be modern medicine's ultimate miracle cure, or an ethically fraught minefield. Or perhaps, as with most things, the answer lies somewhere in the middle. Associate Professor Megan Munsey is the head of the Education, Ethics, Law and Community Awareness Unit at Stem Cells Australia. And Professor Douglas Melton is the co-director of Harvard University's Stem Cell Institute. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, before we get into the details of your work, can we step back to basics? What does stem cell research actually entail? How does it actually work?
Well, maybe I'll have a start at it. Stem cells, as your listeners would know, are unusual because they can be instructed to make any part of the body, any of the various cell types in our body. So researchers are excited about the potential for using them both for transplantation to treat disease and to learn why our bodies slowly decay during disease or aging. And it's an exciting time. There are a couple thousand people here in Melbourne today talking about these issues.
At the conference.
Yes.
So if I have this right, in theory, they can be turned into any cell in our body. But how? How does that work? How's that possible?
Well, it sounds a bit like alchemy, but it is, you take a cell which has this potential and you give it some signals, which means small chemicals or proteins in a dish, and it never happens in one step. So you don't take a stem cell and turn it into a brain cell, but it's a multi-step process, you could say analogous to the development of a person. A child doesn't become a lawyer in one step, but there's a process to become a lawyer.
Mm. So back in the early 2000s, there was a flurry of ethical concern and a flurry of legislation to limit what was allowed with stem cell research. Can you take us back there? What was the concern and what happened? Megan?
So I think you might be referring to the discovery of human embryonic stem cells, which was 20 years ago. Mm. And certainly that captured the community's attention. So we were able to make a particular type of stem cell, these pluripotent stem cells, exactly what Doug was describing, these cells that have the capacity, when given the right signals, to grow into any cell of the body. But to obtain these stem cells in the lab, we had to isolate them from a human embryo. And the human embryos that we have used, and we do continue to use them, although perhaps not as often, and we might talk about that in a moment, these embryos are donated for research. So the embryos were originally created to help couples have a family, to help them overcome infertility. But in some cases, they've had leftover, if you like, for, it's not a very nice way to phrase it, but excess embryos remaining after they completed their infertility treatment. Those embryos have been donated to research, and it's from those embryos we can isolate these stem cells. Now, of course, what the community was concerned about is that at the time, that the scientists were destroying a life. And that's something I've always found a little challenging, because I see an embryo as being a special type or cluster of cells, but not a life. I see it as a life not yet realised. And just to be clear, those embryos that are donated to research, if they weren't donated to research, they would be discarded.
They would be destroyed.
They'd be destroyed. So whilst in isolating the stem cells, we do destroy the embryo was already going to be destroyed. So that was a lot of the community discord. Doug, did you want to make a few comments from an American perspective?
You described it very well, and it may be worth remembering that these embryos were frozen. And so it's hard to think of them as the equivalent of a person. There's something clearly with the potential to be a person, but I can't imagine giving them the rights or the moral equivalence of a person.
And just before we get on to what actually happened in terms of what the legislation was and how it's changed, you said that those embryonic stem cells are not used as often now. Is that because it's no longer necessary?
There's two reasons. Mm. The first is that when we make these particular type of stem cells in the lab, we can grow large numbers of them. We can then freeze them and we share them. So we have an exchange of these important and valuable cells. So you don't, every time you want to do an experiment, you don't have to use an embryo. So that's the first thing. The second thing is the technology has changed. So we have now, from learnings, some research about what controls these particular type of stem cells, we can now actually make a similar type of cell from a skin cell or from a blood cell. So this has changed or added another kind of tool in our repertoire, if you like, about how we can understand and use stem cells in research.
Let's go back to what happened back in the early 2000s. I think President Bush barred federal funding for most human embryonic stem cell research. I think it was in August 2001. What was the impact of those restrictions in the USA, Douglas?
Well, in the U.S., it removed the possibility of funding from our major source of funding, which is called the NIH, the National Institutes of Health. So all of the work had to be done with philanthropic funds. So I would say it didn't stop the research, but it handicapped it. It slowed it down. But as Megan said, one of the great things about being a scientist is we don't really recognize borders in that sense. So there's a lot of sharing of reagents and ideas all of the time. And I'm happy to say Bush's restrictions had no effect on Australia, which has been a really strong source of science in this field for many years.
So Megan, the research was able to keep on going strong during that period here in Australia and, say, in other countries.
Well, I think certainly it was also enabled by some legislation. So we had actually one of the early frameworks, if you like, to enable responsible research. So there were, you might remember, there was a lot of discussion and actually, I think, a conscious vote back in 2002 that allowed Australian researchers to use human embryos in research, not just stem cell research, but in any application that would involve a destruction of a human embryo. And that was allowed, but only when a whole lot of checks and balances were met. And I think it's a good model. If I want to use a human embryo for research, I can't just go to an IVF clinic and put forward my proposition and get access to an embryo. I have to apply to an ethics committee. I also have to apply to a federal government committee. And I have to make a case for why my research can't be met through any other means. And I think I think we do that always with research. We do think deeply about how to achieve our ends in the most ethical and reasonable way. But I think having to articulate that rationalization to others is really worthwhile. And so we, as I said, we have this kind of two-tiered system. So it allows research, but it also, I think, allows some safeguards. So there's a prohibition around purchasing embryos. There's a prohibition around any kind of coercion to maybe give better IVF treatment or something like that. So I think there's some separation and a bit of reflection, which I think is to be encouraged.
On RN, I'm Damien Carrick, and my guests this evening are Associate Professor Megan Munsey. She's the head of the Education, Ethics, Law and Community Awareness Unit at Stem Cells Australia, and also Professor Douglas Melton. He's co-director of Harvard University's Stem Cell Research Institute. Douglas, let's head back a little further back in time. I understand it was family that brought you into stem cell research. Tell me about that.
Well, yes, that's true. As a parent, what I'll describe will be understandable by any parent. When your child has a disease, it gets your attention. And our six-month-old son became what's called type 1 diabetic or juvenile diabetic, which, as you may know, requires the regular, nearly 5-10 times a day, blood sugar measurement by pricking your finger and injecting yourself with insulin. And fortunately, I was in a position as a scientist to switch fields and say, might there be a different way of approaching that? You may not know that it was nearly 100 years ago that insulin was discovered in 1920. And I don't know the numbers of people in Australia, but say worldwide, about 60 million people inject themselves with insulin every day. And so we want to change that and give people using stem cell technology their own capacity to make insulin so they wouldn't be pricking their finger and measuring their sugar, watching their diet and exercise so carefully, and injecting themselves with insulin.
And how far have you come in your work in diabetes?
Well, it's nice of you to ask. I would say not nearly as far as I thought I would when I started on this. I think when I first started on the idea, as Megan said, of coaxing a stem cell into a particular cell type, I think I told my family it would take 4 or 5 years, and that was about 15 years ago. But I'm pleased to say 2 or 3 years ago, we did solve the problem, and we can now make from what we call a stem cell line, the thing Megan referred to, we can make truly unlimited numbers of human insulin-producing cells. And so our challenge now is to find a way to put those into patients and relieve them of this daily management of their blood sugar.
Douglas, is one of the big remaining problems around the immune response? Is that one of the things that makes stem cell treatment hard? It's sort of the same sort of reaction that the transplant patients have.
Exactly right. Most people know that if they were to take cells from another person, their own body's immune system would recognize them as foreign and reject it. So you're absolutely right. And there are two ways we're approaching that. One is called encapsulation, which is essentially just a protective device that allows the key molecules, oxygen and sugar and insulin, to pass across a membrane, but does not allow the cells of the immune system. And so in the first approach, we'll be putting in a little credit card size. Think of it sort of like a tea bag that has a thin membrane on it into people. But we like to think that following that, we can find a way to put masked cells, let's say cloaked cells, which wouldn't be recognized as foreign. And there's lots of findings from cancer immunotherapy, which people may be familiar with, and even studies of the fetal maternal immune reaction. I mean, just remind you that when you were inside your mother, she didn't reject you, but yet you have your father's genes and cells in you. And so we're trying to understand how it is that a pregnant woman does not reject the fetus and use that sort of information to transplant cells. I don't know if that'll work, but that's one of the ideas we're pursuing.
So that research and that production sounds expensive, at least at first. How hard is it to find a solution and then to mass produce it or make it available?
Well, it's a good question. It is quite expensive, but there are a number of ways of thinking about it. Unfortunately, I don't know the numbers here in Australia, but I know them in the U.S. The cost of diabetes care in the U.S. this year will be $284 billion.
Wow.
And so if you think of that plus the cost and the quality of life to the patient, I would say these aren't very expensive experiments. I don't know what the cost will be for the treatment, but as a society, we should keep in mind that we're changing people's lives. It's not wrong in some instances to talk about curing a disease. Mm. And so it's an interesting question. How much would you pay for a cure as opposed to a treatment?
Well, we all do everything we can for our families and for ourselves. And I know, Megan, one of the issues you've raised before is the risk of stem cell tourism when certain treatments aren't available in your own country. Can you tell me about that phenomenon of stem cell tourism? And is it because of inconsistent regulatory and legal frameworks around the world?
I think it's a combination of things. A lot of the great science, like people like Doug are doing, capture people's attentions and give hope to many who are suffering at the moment. And of course, when people read about some of the success that we're having in the stem cell field, they naturally think, where can I go? I don't mind being a guinea pig. I don't mind being part of a research project. And again, we need people to participate and support our science. So we want people to be part of clinical research where they're enrolled in a clinical trial where they're basically contributing to knowledge. What I'm concerned about is perhaps the flip side of that. It's what's happening outside. And it's like almost like a bypass of that responsible translation of our science, where companies and clinics are marketing directly to the consumer that they have the answer. They have the answer now. If you'll just come to me with your checkbook, we can help you. Now, from a patient's perspective, that's pretty alluring. They're frustrated by their options here in Australia. They'll travel abroad, or they might even seek out a clinic here. But unfortunately, what's on offer is completely decoupled from excellent research like Doug's. It's actually, I think it's a mirage.
Is it a black and white hard line? I mean, whenever there's medical technology with a lot of potential, some people will make claims that maybe aren't, I don't know, entirely true. They might oversell the potential of their work. How do we, as the general public, know what's real and what's not? And even more problematically, if people with an illness make a calculation that, yeah, I'm going in with my eyes open, what do we say? I mean, I know there's a couple of elements to that question.
Yeah. But look, I think it's a fantastic series of questions, and I'm sure Doug would like to say a few words as well. But if I could just start off by saying that you've got to do your research. Everybody I talk to talks about that they want to do their research. And I think, you know, we've got to find out information about what's happening, what's really available. But it's what you then do with that information. So I just really caution people about making decisions based on, you know, that keep you kind of alert on that's very easy to make marketing claims, but you need to see whether there's substance to those claims. Really what you need is to talk to your doctor, your specialist, the person who knows you and your condition best about what's on offer. So you need to be able to have a conversation to do that. And I think one of the most difficult aspects is that at the moment what's advertised is unregulated. And it's very, very alluring. It's also highly profitable, so it looks pretty slick.
And most of it is unproven.
Oh, absolutely.
In addition to being unregulated.
I believe, Doug, the US recently passed something called the Right to Try Law, which lets terminally ill patients try experimental therapies. Now, as a researcher in an emerging field and somebody with an understanding of what it's like to have, you know, a family member at need, how do you feel about that law?
Well, I think, as Megan said, it's an interesting puzzle for the society to consider. Is if someone has a terminally ill disease, a cancer, and there's no known treatment, it seems logical that one might say, well, if I'm going to pass away anyway and I'd like to try a mixture of Coca-Cola and apricot seeds, who's to say no? On the other hand, also as Megan indicated, this opens them to be taken advantage of by unethical scientists or businessmen to say, I can cure your disease, but they have no evidence for it. When I talk to the students at Harvard, I like to point out there's a sort of an analogy here with fake news, is we should learn to ask, what is the evidence for this claim? And that's really what Megan was talking about, is science has, here in Australia and elsewhere, a very long history of clinical trials where you have to provide evidence and controls to say there's reason to imagine that this treatment will give you benefit. Otherwise, you're open to all comers to try things which will just lead to abuse.
Mm. And I also think it's worth mentioning that it can be a deviation from conventional care. So it can lead people along a pathway where they are not only exposed to perhaps some risk to the health that they do have, but they also, I think, are a risk of psychological harm, financial harm possibly, mm-hmm. where they may well want to mortgage their house to access this treatment. And I've seen, unfortunately, some examples where the treatment hasn't worked. It hasn't caused death. It hasn't necessarily caused a further reduction in health. The person's actually been blamed and told it's their fault that the treatment hasn't worked. And so they feel, you know, they've already suffering, they've already got a chronic problem, and yet again another thing is being sort of laid at their feet. That's the reason why it hasn't worked, is because your stem cells are no good. Where in actual fact, I suspect there was never any stem cells put back in the patient. Mm.
Goodness me. So you're talking about the far end of the extreme where real snake oil salesmen or women are you know, leading people up the garden
and,
path.
And you were asking before about what can people do. Well, I really think it's very hard to navigate that. We have a website through our international society where we have a series of questions. The website's called A Closer Look at Stem Cells. And, you know, we've put a lot of thought into how to help people kind of get a bit more information. So it's really to think twice, to stop and maybe assess what you're being told by someone who has a conflict of interest in terms of getting you to buy their product against what perhaps we would say is the current state of play. Mm. And the final comment I was going to make around that kind of conundrum is that it matters what condition you have. So whilst Doug's doing some fantastic work in diabetes with a very tailored and carefully designed sort of experimental protocol to make these cells, you can't just extrapolate that protocol and say, well, therefore those stem cells or those cells made from stem cells can help someone with Parkinson's disease or someone with a particular eye disease.
Well, before I let you both go, what are the breakthroughs or the research in stem cells that you're most excited about right now?
Well, there are a few diseases where I think we're seeing positive results already from stem cell treatment. Most people know bone marrow transplants, which is a kind of blood stem cell, work very effectively for certain cancers. There have been exciting results of transplanting skin stem cells on patients which are unable to maintain normal skin, and recent results on a form of macular degeneration. I like to think that if you had me back in a couple of years, I'd be saying, and also diabetes, but we don't know that yet.
Fingers crossed.
The other area which is advancing quite quickly is, and Megan alluded to this, is using stem cells not to transplant them back into patients, but to use them to understand degenerative disease. So in simple form, imagine Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, where you make a stem cell from that person, turn it into the neuron that becomes dysfunctional in the disease, and study that neuron in a dish to say, what's wrong with you, and can we find a drug that might slow your degeneration? So this is obviously different from transplanting cells back into the brain. The hope there would be to develop some treatment which would slow the degeneration in the first instance. So those are the areas I'm most excited about.
Megan?
Yeah, so I would certainly echo that. And I think the idea of disease in a dish, disease modeling, is a real new frontier. And it's really been enabled through the technology I alluded to before. It's got a fancy acronym, iPSCs. But this idea that we can take a cell from a patient, this is a discovery Nat made 11 years ago, but this idea we can take a cell from a patient and then study what happens in disease in a dish, I just think is mind-blowing. And the idea that you can then try different drugs to see whether you can have an effect, and colleagues here in Melbourne are doing some great work, and also you have them have some great colleagues at Harvard doing a similar project around motor neuron disease. And I think that's a great example, because we know it's certainly an unmet need to try to find something to help arrest the progression in that disease. So if we can make a discovery based on stem cell science, they'll make a real difference in their lives. It won't be a cellular therapy, but it may be a new drug.
I might just add, and the reason we're excited about that is to remind people that before the advent of stem cell technologies, if you wanted to develop a drug, drug companies generally used rodent cells and the wrong cell type. So even if one used a rodent brain cell, that's not like the cell that is defective in human disease. So as Megan said, the excitement now is not only is it the right cell, but it's the right organism. And I'm very hopeful about the future of drug development because of that.
Professor Douglas Melton and Associate Professor Megan Munsey have been my guests in the drawing room. Megan is the head of the Education, Ethics, Law and Community Awareness Unit at Stem Cells Australia, and Douglas is the co-director of Harvard's Stem Cell Institute. A great pleasure talking to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And they've both been part of the International Society for Stem Cell Research's annual meeting, which was held recently in Melbourne.